This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
How do you motivate various countries to abide by international law? It would seem to me that you need an enforcement mechanism. At present, there is an arms embargo, but countries that violate it don't get punished because the UN has no power.
That's Jason Pack of the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis on the impact of arms embargo violations on potential negotiations to end the Libyan crisis. Details coming up also. Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser is in Ethiopia for a five-day diplomatic and trade mission. And thousands of animals, including elephants, lions, and giraffes, are being moved from a drought-stricken park in Zimbabwe. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A top story, the UN Refugee Agency reports hundreds of thousands of displaced people in the Democratic Republic of Congo's North Kivu and Ituri provinces are living in abject poverty and subject to mass human rights violations. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
A wave of brutal attacks by armed groups in North Kivu and Ituri provinces in June triggered the flight of some 300,000 people, mainly women and children, from their homes. The UN Refugee Agency says these forcibly displaced people are living in dire conditions with host communities. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balar says the civilians are unprotected, subjected to extreme human rights violations on a daily basis, and living in fear of death and destruction.
5 months on from the June attacks, killings, sexual violence, and abductions persist amid continuing conflict. Many women and children are still living in precarious conditions, sleeping in the open or in the overcrowded public spaces, further exposing them to risks of harassment, assault, or sexual exploitation.
About 100 different armed groups are operating in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Balar says many of the violations taking place are linked to decades-long conflicts among these groups and the government, as well as inter-ethnic violence and the illegal exploitation of mineral resources. He tells VOA the conflict and brutality against the civilian population are overshadowed by an ongoing Ebola epidemic in the region.
That's a really worrying and dangerous mix of everything happening in there. We have heard of reports, you may already have heard it here, that many of the health clinics have been attacked and not spared as well in those parts of the DRC.
The UNHCR is stepping up its response to the growing displacement crisis in eastern DRC. It is deploying additional staff to the area. It is providing basic non-food relief and has built communal hangars and emergency family shelters to help keep the displaced safe. The agency, however, says it is seriously short of cash. Without additional funds, the UNHCR warns it will not be able to continue its support for these desperate people. The agency reports it has received only 57% of the $150 million needed to run its humanitarian operations in DRC this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A report by the UN panel of experts of the International Sanctions Committee on Libya reveals that member states, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, Turkey, and Jordan, have violated the UN arms embargo imposed on Libya, saying they routinely and blatantly supplied weapons with little effort to disguise the source. Both parties of the conflict, the internationally recognized Government of National Accord and its rival, the Libyan National Army, headed by General Khalifa Haftar, received weapons and military equipment, technical support, and they continue to reject diplomacy. Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libyan Analysis, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the impact of arms embargo violations on potential negotiations to end the Libyan crisis.
It's an open secret that the arms embargo has been violated since it was put into place. And the only difference is that since the new conflict for Tripoli began in April of this year, that those violations have increased. So Turkey has always been supplying the Tripoli-based side, and the UAE, Saudi, and Russia have always been supplying Haftar and the eastern-based side. The only thing is that those supports have increased in the last 8 months. And of course, that motivates the sides to think we can win, because if they had no external support, they'd run out of money, they'd run out of cash, and they'd have to negotiate. But if General Haftar believes the UAE is going to give me more and more drones or dump billions of dollars, or the Russians are going to come with mercenaries and training, that gives a hope that maybe they can tip the balance and win the conflict.
So what would stop such regional and international interference in Libya?
That's a $64,000 question. How do you motivate various countries to abide by international law? It would seem to me that you need an enforcement mechanism. At present, there is an arms embargo, but countries that violate it don't get punished because the UN has no power. It's not going to sanction the UAE or Russia, particularly because Russia is on the Security Council, for violating the arms embargo. It would require a country like the US or the UK to say, we're going to invest political capital in this. We're going to risk our interests elsewhere to punish people who violated the arms embargo over Libya. And at present, neither the U.S., the U.K., or other major powers have shown that they're willing to create an enforcement mechanism.
So what's preventing the United Nations Security Council from taking actions against countries who violated the arms embargo?
They can take all the action they want in terms of writing reports, making statements, or even potentially trying to pass resolutions, but the U.N. has no enforcement power. The U.N. as an entity can give legal cover for states who wish to enforce its resolutions. If states don't wish to enforce its resolutions, the UN lacks an army, it lacks a diplomatic corps, and it lacks the ability to have financial sanctions enforced. So there's really very little that can be done if major international powers don't want to use either financial, military, or diplomatic tools to enforce UN resolutions.
So what's the way out of the stalemate in the Libyan crisis?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I imagine that it needs to be U.S. and U.K. leadership. Maybe. There hasn't been any movement in that direction, but I would be very encouraged if I saw it.
That was Jason Pack of the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. President Paul Kagame is disputing media reports that his government has spent $10 million on hacking software from Israel to spy on dissidents and opponents using the WhatsApp application, which is supposed to be secure. This comes as the prosecution in many political court cases likes to say that evidence was collected from politicians' WhatsApp activities. But even if it doesn't hack WhatsApp, Kagame admits his government does keep a very close eye on opponents. Eugene Nwimana has more details from Kigali, Rwanda.
Read about that story.
That's Kagame disputing allegations that the Rwandan government has paid dearly for technology to monitor its enemies. Allegations were revealed in the London-based newspaper Financial Times.
Well, I actually wish I could have access to this technology. I just wish. But I also know that it is very costly. That's what I have heard. I've read about it. And I know how best to spend my money.
Many dissident politicians and human rights activists have been struggling in court cases with evidence collected discreetly from their social media platforms. Critics say this violates rights of expression and sows fear among those who oppose Kagame and his government. Kagame says they only spy on their enemies, as other countries do, and that those who are called human rights activists are criminals.
But we've done intelligence, and we do it, and we are going to do it for the future. That's how countries operate. I don't think Rwanda would be an exception. That's how we get to know. We know our enemies. We know plenty about our enemies and those who even support our enemies. We know a lot about that.
25 years after the genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi, Rwanda has achieved a lot in many areas, especially in technology. It is the first African country to have electric cars and locally made smartphones. The government says it doesn't embrace technology for fighting dissidents. However, many human rights organizations accuse the government of making the political arena very tight and scary. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Thousands of displaced people in the Democratic Republic of Congo's North Kivu and Ituri provinces are living in abject poverty and subject to mass human rights violations. And President Paul Kagame is disputing media reports that his government has spent $10 million on hacking software from Israel to spy on dissidents and opponents. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Thousands of motorcycle taxi drivers blocked streets in Cameroon's capital today after city officials barred them from accessing certain commercial and residential areas. Officials say the restrictions are needed for security reasons. The bikers say the cutoff hurts their livelihoods. Moki Edwin Kinzaka reports from Yaoundé.
Despite a strong presence of anti-riot police throughout the city, groups of commercial taxi bikers paralyzed Yaoundé on Tuesday, blocking streets and prompting many businesses to shut down. Dieudonné Monono, president of the Yaoundé Bikers Association, YABA, says the bikers are protesting the city's decision to ban them from the main commercial centers and neighborhoods where they pick up most of their customers. Monono says the bikers need the access to make a living.
Most of those people riding the bikes are university graduates, and then just because of lack of jobs, they've decided to create jobs for themselves so that they can be able to live. But when the government just get up and then they say that they don't want bikes to be moving in town, then I consider that a very bad move.
Monono said the government should appreciate commercial taxi bikers for being self-reliant and paying taxes instead of leaving the country for Europe, as some of the unemployed peers have done. The decision to prohibit bikers from doing business in the city center in front of embassies and residential areas where senior officials live was made by the governor of Yaoundé's center region, Nasseri Paul Biya. Biya says he wants the city to have better security and more order. He says the restriction is part of plans to give Yaoundé a facelift for international visitors.
Il est question pour eux de nous aider.
He says it is imperative for the bikers to help the government in keeping the capital city clean, especially now that Cameroon is preparing to host several international meetings, including a meeting of heads of state of the Central African Economic and Monetary Community and several sporting events, including the African Football Cup of Nations. He says insecurity must be deterred. The Yaoundé City Council reports there are at least 30,000 bikers in Yaoundé. Most of them transport people from neighborhoods that do not have car taxi due to the bad state of roads leading to the city center. 40-year-old businessman Jeremiah Njoya says the business has been infiltrated by robbers.
A cross-section of them create very alarming situation in the city of Yaoundé. They attack people at night and even during the day. They seize back from women. Most of them are armed robbers.
Monono acknowledged that a few bikers were arrested by the police and had been found guilty of crimes. But he says in every profession, there are bad people, and it is the duty of government to fish them out and protect the public. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaounde.
Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser is on a five-day diplomatic and trade mission to Ethiopia. Bowser left last Friday with a delegation of 70. The goal is to establish trade relations with different industries in Ethiopia. Bowser met with local leaders and government officials in Addis Ababa, the capital, and Lalibela, a northern city about 531 miles away. She also had an audience with Sahalawark Zewde, Ethiopia's first female president, and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who recently won the Nobel Peace Prize. The D.C. metropolitan region has the largest Ethiopian-born community in the U.S. More than 30,000 Ethiopians have settled in parts of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Bowser's trip comes a year after Abiy came to D.C. to talk to members of the Ethiopian community at the convention center. At that time, Bowser joined Abiy on stage and announced July 28th as Ethiopia Day in D.C. Zimbabwe's Wildlife Agency says it will move thousands of animals, including elephants, lions, and giraffes, from a drought-stricken park in its largest ever translocation. The move from Save Conservancy, a major park in the southeast, to three other game reserves more than 1,000 kilometers away will begin when the annual summer rain comes, hopefully this week. At least 200 elephants already have died at two other parks, as one of the worst droughts in history has dried up water holes, severely reduced famed Victoria Falls, and hampered hydroelectric operations. Officials say they are moving 600 elephants, two prides of lions, a pack of wild dogs, 50 buffaloes, 40 giraffes, and 2,000 impalas. Hungry elephants have been breaking out of wildlife areas and raiding human settlements in search for food, posing a threat to communities. Millions of people also face severe food insecurity. As West Africans in Burkina Faso and northern Ghana know well, the long dry season means little farm work and often too little to eat. Fortunately, there is a growing demand in the West for the fruit of the iconic, if long ignored, baobab tree. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Nick Salter, co-founder of Aduna. It's a London-based food company that works with local women's groups and grassroots nonprofits to create demand for natural ingredients from small-scale producers. Mr. Salter began by explaining what a baobab tree is.
The baobab tree is a magnificent specimen. In fact, the baobab is one of the oldest living species on the planet. The very oldest baobabs are between 4,000 and 5,000 years old.
Is the baobab tree endangered in any way?
There are examples, such as in Madagascar, where these wonderful old ancient trees have been felled to be able to make room for short-term cash crops like sisal, for example, simply because there is no monetary benefit for the people that live around them. And it's a wild harvested crop, so there's no such thing as a baobab plantation.
Tell me a little bit about the environment, the climate in Burkina Faso and northern Ghana, where you're doing business.
It's a fairly harsh environment. You're in the drylands region. You're on the very periphery of the Sahel, whereby you have 5 months of rain a year, but you have 7 months of severe drought and dryness when there's very little work and there's very little to eat. It's a tough life. And if we create a successful demand for baobab in the West, then you're starting to create industry and being able to put money into people's hands within those communities in Africa.
Where does the baobab grow?
It grows in 32 different countries across Africa, but the majority of the fruits that it produces goes to waste because there isn't a demand, there isn't a market for it. But if you create that monetary benefit, if you can put a value on them, then they will survive.
Please describe the baobab fruit.
As far as we know, it is the only fruit in the world that dries naturally on the branch. It literally bakes in the sunshine for 6 months of the year. And when you crack it open, what you're effectively looking at is what looks like a calcified grapefruit. It's a solid white pulp. And what we do with that pulp is we crush it, we take out the seeds, we take out the fibers, and we sieve it and create a fine powder, which is very easy to be able to integrate into various different dishes.
What are some examples of how this baobab powder can be used in typical American or European homes?
Would be typically be used in shakes, in smoothies, ice creams, biscuits, chocolates, sprinkling onto yogurt. It's used in so many different ways.
As a marketing issue, do you advertise the product for its flavor or more for its nutritional value?
Both. From a flavor perspective, it's a citrusy, sherbety, lemony, mango, pineapple-y kind of flavor. But from a health perspective, it has 6 times the vitamin C of an orange. And it's also nearly 50% fiber, half of which is soluble. So very strong on that front.
If it's so tasty and so good for you, why do its fruits go to waste? Is it really unappreciated where it grows?
Well, it depends what you mean by appreciated. So there's people who will know it in the villages and the communities where it comes from, but it isn't a staple. It isn't something that would be used in every meal. And at the same time, there are more baobab trees and more fruit than there are people to actually consume them.
I know Aduna's got sort of a double mission. Obviously, you want to make a profit, but you also want to help the small landholders in Africa. Have you seen that this project has really made a difference in people's lives?
Hugely so. This is a new income for people that otherwise would not have that income, certainly within the dry season. And we've been doing this now for 6 or 7 years, and you see communities that now do have roofs on the top of the shack. There is now a bicycle, etc. The kid is going to school. You can see that it is most certainly making a difference. And we also have third-party monitoring and evaluation and independent conversations with the villages and the women's groups and the harvesters as to how they feel and how they see it's impacted their lives.
That was Nick Salter, co-founder of Aduna, a small London-based food company. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips from New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Africa, I'm James Batte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.